Hi, everyone. Welcome. I'm so excited to see this crowd. We have a really exciting panel here. I would think it's the most exciting panel of the event. It's called Saving Earth. We only have an hour to figure it out, so we'll have to operate pretty quickly and get started soon. Let me tell you, I'm Beth Daly. I work at a news outlet called Inside Climate News. It's a nonprofit news outlet, and if you like to read about climate and energy environmental news, please check us out. We're good. We've won a couple of Pulitzer. And prior to that, I was the environment reporter at the Boston Globe for many, many years and an investigative reporter elsewhere as well. So before I do introductions, I'm going to start someplace pretty dark. And how many people here read about the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report last week? All right, good. So did you walk away feeling a little depressed? Well, it was pretty dire. If you look at the headlines, what I took away from it, and I jotted some notes, was that the 2020s could be one of humanity's last chances to avert devastating impacts from climate change. The panel states in really plain language that averting a climate crisis will require a wholesale reinvention of our global economy. By 2040, there could be more global food shortages, more inundations of the ilk we've seen with the last hurricane in Florida, and a refugee crisis that the planet has never yet experienced. But, you know, hidden in the report, behind the headlines, and only a few news outlets really wrote about it deeply, was hope. And it came in the view of, you know, technological solutions. You know, geoengineering, biochar, lots of ways to save soil sequestration, lots of ways to save the earth. And so that's what we're going to talk about today. First, I'd like to introduce Charles Mann to my left, author of The Wizard and the Prophet, which really boils down the argument how to save the earth through the lens of two scientists that really I didn't know much about. One is Norman Borlaug, who really was the father of the Green Revolution, who sort of hastened the feeding of millions of people and prevented the premature death of six, I forgot how many you just told me, but.
Well, that's what the economists say, 600 million.
600 million, Paul Auder, through technology. And the other person is Voigt, who really defined this idea of Earth having a carrying capacity, that there's a finite resources and we need to live within those means. You may know Charles Mann as the author of 1491, which is my first introduction to him. He is a correspondent for Atlantic Monthly, Science, Wired, and writes often on the intersection of technology and science and commerce. He's written four other books. I've read, The Aspirin Wars, which is fantastic, but has a list of awards that would take me this entire hour to relay. But we're really grateful that you're here. To my direct right is David Grinspoon, who wrote Earth in Human Hands. If Charles' book is about two different viewpoints told from a reporter standpoint, which I think it is, I'd say it is, David is a book full of hope. You know, it dreams about the future, not with the sad eyes of humanity that we've really messed up the earth, but one that can really solve the problems that we created, because we're the first species of our kind to see the problems we created and have a chance to stop it before it gets too late. He comes at it through his astrobiologist viewpoint, and it's fascinating. You're a great astrobiologist. He was the first astrobiology chair at the Library of Congress in 2013. He currently is a senior scientist at the Planetary Science Institute and an adjunct professor at the University of Colorado. He's worked on several spacecraft missions and has also written three other books, and has won a multitude of awards too, including the Carl Sagan Medal for Public Communication, which I think has to be pretty close to your heart given your relationship with Carl Sagan. We'd love to hear about, I'm sure. Yeah. So let's begin. I'm going to give both of you about 6-8 minutes to tell us about your book. Why'd you write it? What do you want people to take away with it? And we'll take it from there. Two points of order. We want this to be a participatory conversation, so raise hands, ask questions. I'll keep an eye out for you once I ask a couple of questions. There'll be book signing at the end of the hour in the back, where you can buy copies of both their books and get them signed. So let's begin. I'll start with you, Charles.
Hi, I'm Charles Mann, as she said. I would actually encourage people in the back to sit closer to the front.
Thank you.
I don't have any communicable diseases. I don't think anybody else does. And also, it helps us to see you. If I see a whole lot of bored faces, I can try and turn the conversation over to David, for example. And if you're so far away, I can't tell. So if this gets dull, it's on you guys in the back, okay? But I'm serious. Come up front.
Come up.
It's much more cozy. I tell you, I'll drone away for a few minutes while I let you come up front and tell you about how I came to write this book. It began really when my daughter was born. And if any of you have had children and are a father, you know that there's this conspiracy, a kind of benign conspiracy to convince you that you have something to do with the birth. They make you breathe and count and take classes and so forth. And then at the end, after the child is born, they throw you out. And so I was standing outside the hospital at 3 o'clock in the morning, and the thought popped into my head that when my daughter was my age, there'd be almost 10 billion people in the world. And this is something I thought about, I knew, but I guess it really hit me. I guess I had more skin in the game or something. I thought, you know, how is that gonna work? You know, how are we gonna feed everybody? How are we gonna get water to everybody? How are we gonna get energy to everybody? And of course, what are we gonna do about climate change? And one of the other things that I know has happened in my lifetime, in the lifetime of many of you here, is that the world has made an enormous leap in affluence. And so not only are there going to be 10 billion people in the world, but a huge number of those people are going to be middle class. And they're going to want all the things that you and I want. You know, they're going to nice homes, nice clothes, nice cars, you know, the odd chunk of Toblerone, right? Toblerone for 10 billion people. I mean, how are we going to do this? And so I'm a science journalist, and I started asking people I would interview, like David here, you know, what are we going to do? And after a while, I realized that their answers fell into two broad categories, which I thought of you know, as wizards and prophets, and that these two categories were each associated with a dead guy nobody's ever heard of. And I thought, you know, this is kind of interesting. Maybe somebody should write a book. And after a while, I thought, maybe me. And that's how the book began.
That's good. Let's go, Dave.
Wow, that's great. Good afternoon. I'm David Grinspoon. I'm an astrobiologist. What even is that? It's astrobiology is the scientific study of the possibility for life elsewhere in the universe, trying to put life on this planet in a cosmic context. My background is as a planetary scientist. As a kid, I was fascinated by, you know, first Apollo and then the first missions to Mars and Venus and other places, and was very much swept up in science fiction and real science, and just felt myself propelled to want to be a space scientist. At the same time, growing up in the 70s and 80s, I was definitely aware of various threats to our future. I was very influenced by Carl Sagan, you mentioned, as a planetary scientist, but also as the first person I really heard warning about nuclear winter, and in fact, also the first person I heard talking about greenhouse climate change on Earth as a threat, and relating that to climate change on other planets and so forth. So all that was sort of a stew that led me to both be interested in space exploration and the question of life elsewhere, but also aware of the connections between those explorations and our growing knowledge of our influence on our own planet and our responsibilities. And then the specific opportunity that allowed me to write Earth in Human Hands was that there was this new position at the Library of Congress, the chair of astrobiology I saw advertised in 2012, and they wanted people to propose projects on the intersection between astrobiology and wider humanistic concerns. So I wrote a proposal to study the Anthropocene from an astrobiology point of view. The Anthropocene being the name we've given for the new phase of Earth history that we've entered into now, because there's a new force changing the planet, the force being the combined activities of humanity. And so my idea was to look at this as a planetary transition. My whole career has been about studying transitions on Earth and other planets, how they gain habitability, how they lose habitability, how climate changes as a result of other changes on a planet. And I thought, what would it look like to think of the Anthropocene in terms of planetary history, not just as a set of problems confronting our civilization, but as a new phenomenon on the planet? So that was what led me ultimately to write Earth in Human Hands and to hopefully gain some new insight into, sort of another way of really phrasing the question, what are we? What are we doing here? And can we get perspective on ourselves and how we fit into the planet? And it's interesting to me that I hear you and other people tell me that my book seems hopeful to them, because I feel very concerned about the 21st century, the IPCC report. This is serious. I do think that the 21st century is going to be hugely challenging for our species, and we're not going to escape a lot of damage because we're making some mistakes. But I also do believe there's going to be a 22nd and a 23rd and a 24th century for humanity, and thinking about what that is going to look like and what vision we want to create, not just what we want to avoid in the near future, I think is essential, actually, for us to think clearly about what we're doing on this planet. And that perspective comes out sort of naturally from my taking a deep time look at our existence here.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. I have a few questions, but again, I'll open up to the audience in just a little bit. So I wanted to ask you first, David, because you have this really interesting idea of planetary intelligence, and it's how we're not there yet. Can you explain sort of what you're talking about and how we might get to this idea of planetary intelligence where we're not going to be our own doom?
Sure. So when I asked this question, what is really new about the Anthropocene from the Earth's point of view? There's a lot of criticisms of the notion of the Anthropocene, and one obvious one is this is really arrogant and self-aggrandizing. Why should we name a geological age after ourselves? Is that just, are we just putting ourselves on a pedestal? Or is there some actual new distinction between the past and the present that is worthy of a new geological stage? And when I look at that and look at the in order to look at that question clearly, I try to look at the past transitions on our planet and see is there something different at work here? And there is, and what I summarize, sort of a book-length idea, is that what's really new is that now cognitive processes have become planetary processes, that our ideas and our mental activities enabled by technology have gotten to the point now where they're interfacing with planetary processes. And that is a transition as profound as the other great transitions in the history of Earth, the origin of life, the takeover of Earth by life. There are these eon boundaries. There's only been three or four of them, the whole history of the planet. I would maintain the advent of cognitive life as a force that is affecting the planet is significant. But I parse that into two different phases. And this is where planetary intelligence comes in. I think there's, I talk about planetary changes, of four kinds of planetary change. The first is just random natural disasters and asteroid hits or whatever. The second is biologically mediated change where, the oxygen catastrophe where life evolves in some way that is bad for other life. That's happened many times. But then the third and fourth kinds of change are where cognitive processes enter into it. And I think it's an important distinction. The third is what I call inadvertent planetary catastrophe, where a species like ours that has developed cognitive faculties gets very good at solving local survival problems, and at first is completely unaware that they're having global effects. And then there's another stage, and I would, in a way, phrase our current struggle as making that transition to where that awareness of global consequences then feeds back into those activities that are changing the planet. And so to me, that intentional change, that conscious change, is the key difference, inadvertent to intentional. And if you look at it that way, then in a sense, the Anthropocene can be seen as a hopeful change, because I argue we're just at the beginning of that phase where there's an awareness of what we're doing, and that feeds back, obviously too slowly, imperfectly, but there are plenty of examples of, and that's a way of framing our challenge. And what I describe as planetary intelligence is where that that mode of changing the planet, I don't think we have the choice to not be planet changers anymore. So that's a question of how we're going to be planet changers. And that's, I think, an interesting way in which my ideas map into this wizard prophet continuum or spectrum, because I regard both of them as sort of ends of a spectrum, but they're both in the category of aware planet changers and how we choose to do that.
Right.
So planetary intelligence is the capacity to intentionally interact with the planet as opposed to inadvertently. And the last thing I'll say is that I also relate this to SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And you might say, why? It's because I think it's valuable to abstract what's happening here on Earth and ask, is this transition to a new mode of interaction with the planet something that we can imagine happening elsewhere? And I propose that it is, and I also suggest ways in which that perspective can help us gain important insight into our challenges in the future when we deconvolve it from particular challenges we have to the overall mechanistic challenge of learning how to gracefully interact our activities with pre-existing planetary systems.
Yeah, but I mean, just following up on that, and Charles, a bit, but can we get there? I mean, in the end of your book, you said it's easy as training, toilet training or something, that we would be able to be this aware and not create our own destruction. But it seems you look around the political spectrum and what's going on, we're not there yet. And will we get there? And
Of course, I can't give you a yes, no answer. Yeah, nobody knows. And one thing I did while I was at the Library of Congress was a little side project called a Brief History of the Future, where I examined predictions of now from 100, 200 years ago. And even really smart people, even people that got some of the important pieces, people basically got the internet, people basically got the energy crisis, and you know, but nobody at all predicted the present well. And one thing I'm sure of is that nobody knows what the world's going to be like 100, 200 years from now. Not economists, not climate modelers, because it's the game changers we don't see coming. So I can't give you a yes, no, but what I can tell you is that the deep history of humanity is one of radical reinvention in response to crisis. And I'm not talking now about the history of the last 10,000 years. I'm talking about the history of the last million years, where we've almost been wiped out at various times, and we've had existential threats, and we've reinvented ourselves in a particular way by widening our ability to work in wider circles and to coordinate with future generations. And so I think there are hopeful lessons from our past. There are plenty of examples of how we are gaining this ability, even sometimes in spite of ourselves, to solve global problems with global efforts through a sort of enlightened self-interest, even if it's not always through altruism. So my best guess is that we will get there bumbling towards it, not best case scenario where we avoid a lot of pain. We will create a lot of pain and displacement and disaster. The 21st century might be as bad as the 20th century. And when I say that, people say, oh, the 20th century was so great. What are you talking about? Well, it wasn't for the hundreds of millions of people in famines and wars. And I see that level of disaster coming because we're being too slow in developing these capacities. But we are developing them. 100 years from now, we'll be post-fossil fuel. Our population will have stabilized, and I think we'll be repairing some of the damage.
Well, let's talk a little bit about how we're going to get there. Because when I read your book, and you have a fantastic explanation of Norman Borlaug and his efforts to really, through amazing odds, like his conditions we were talking about prior to coming out here. I mean, you have to read the book. It's you know, living in these conditions and having so many bad things happen to him, and he persevered in the Green Revolution and helping feed people. But that is a great example of technology solving a problem. And now we're faced with this problem that's in our backyard every day, which is climate change. And is climate different? Can it change? Can it have the same, the technology solve that, or something different about?
Well, there's something different about climate change. When you're dealing with the Green Revolution, you're talking about feeding people. Mm-hmm. Everybody has a need. And so if you get food, obviously this is good. Similarly, if you have water shortage and give people water, that's good. Climate change is a byproduct of other things. And so there's a certain way it's presented to most people, like you go through this horrendous effort and dance through all these hoops, and then at the end, you've avoided something. You haven't made yourself better off. And so that puts people in a different mindset. And I also think when we're talking about that it's important to remember the speed at which things actually happen.
Right.
The example I like to give is that most of us have probably recently been to a pharmacy. And if you go to a pharmacy and you buy something off the shelf, there's three things you know. You know that whatever it is says on the label is probably actually in the jar or bottle. that it will probably, if it says it cures headaches, it will probably actually will have some effect on your headache, and it won't kill you. And so we just think of this as a matter of course. But in fact, that was a response of a 100-year struggle. It began in the 1880s when patent medicines came around. They were killing all sorts of people. Huge fights in Congress against the patent medicine industry. It took 25 years, and they passed the Pure Food and Drug Act of 1906. And that just said that the ingredients in the bottle had to be written down accurately. It didn't say it had to be safe or effective. You could kill people, and it would be perfectly legal. And in fact, that happened all the time. Until there was, in 1938, there was a scandal of the elixir sulfanamide, and several hundred people died when people got something properly labeled with strychnine, and there's a big scandal, and they passed that law that said it actually has to be safe. Okay, so that's a 60-year struggle to say that something has to be safe that is sold to the public. And then it wasn't until 1964 that the FDA started saying, well, it actually has to also be effective. Now, I think that's the scale at which things happen. Now, look at climate change. Most people in America and the rest of the world first hear about it in 1988 with James Hansen's dramatic testimony before Congress that climate change has begun. Before that, very few people have heard of it. And when he makes his testimony, the senators say, well, what are we supposed to do? And Hansen doesn't really have an answer if you read his testimony. And the reason is there's no PV panels, you know, that really work. There's no wind industry that really works. There's no energy storage industry that really works. There's no alternative. So they're saying, well, what are we supposed to do absent just turning off industrial civilization? He doesn't have an answer. 30 years later, we have an answer. We actually have technologies that are getting close to be able to do that. That is lightning speed. That is much faster than something where you're actually talking about poisoning people. So, you know, the question is whether it's fast enough. But, you know, when I look at this, you know, with a sort of reasonable historian's lens, I think we're actually moving really quickly on this.
Where does the intersection of policy come into all this? I mean, it's an important piece of it, right? Like, because we have, the technology is there now, we all know it. But so, through the wizard kind of lens, like, how do you get there then? Like,
the technology is also the province. We have, the issue is this, the larger issues are always social. They always have been. And the fact is, our Congress is awful, but our Congress has always been awful. This was the sort of people that protected for 60 years the ability for drug makers to make things that didn't work or were dangerous. And Congress valiantly protected them for 60 years. Is it any surprise that they're going to be an obstacle to replacing the fossil fuel industry? That's what they do.
Right.
You know, so I remember I was sitting in a cafe once. There was a famous biologist who lived in my town, Lynn Margulis. And I was reading the New York Times, and I had a sad face on because our Congress had just done something stupid with regard to climate change, like voted down cap and trade or whatever it was. And she said, "What's the matter?" She came up, and I said, "You know, our Congress." And she said, "Well, duh."
she figures prominently in book in many places.
Yeah,
she's kind of like the.
She's a third character in the book. She's kind of like a Greek chorus who makes fun of me all the time for my innocent and stupid ideas, like that Congress might do something. And, you know, they never have. They never will. And so that's just a condition of life, and just get over it. Pull up your socks and say that this is not going to be easy.
Right. Well, let me ask you a question, like both through your own lens, right? And Charles, you were careful in the book not to give your opinion. But I'd like you to pick a lens, wizard or prophet, and David, through your own lens, which I think leans towards wizardry. But so the first question is, how are we going to continue to feed? We have three problems. We have many problems, but three problems is energy access. Moving forward, there's a billion people without cooling right now, and a lot more without energy access. How are we going to solve that problem through your lens? How are we going to solve climate change, and how are we going to solve feeding people? And let's start with feeding people. Like, what do you see the future?
Me?
Yeah, in 2100.
Well, I'm going to, because the basic idea in my book is that there's these two ways of thinking about it. One is to say essentially that science and technology properly applied can let us produce our way. We can make more, be smart, make more. And the other is to say, no, look, there's these planetary limits. We have to fit in with natural ecosystems. There's these natural processes with limits that we transgress to our peril. And that's what I call the prophet side. And that's the side, basically, the environmental movement. And part of the argument of the book is to say that what these really reflect is deep values that people hold. And so I'm going to, just for the moment, put on the prophet's hat and let you take the wizard's hat, which you're actually literally wearing.
be pointed.
Yeah. That a prophet say, look, the industrial agriculture that we have has really, really bad environmental side effects, and they're going to bite us in the ass probably shouldn't say that in a church. and we have to stop this. And that's the fundamental objection to things like genetically modified foods, is that they feel like we have this fire going and you're telling us to pour gasoline on it. That's the wrong way to do it. And what we need to do is reconfigure agriculture. And among other things, that would involve switching a lot away from cereal crops like wheat and rice to tree crops, which use much less fertilizer, much less water, cause much less erosion, produce more per hectare than is. And since much of our crops are used for industrial purposes anyway, they're just as useful. You can also graze cattle underneath them or grow things. And you need to have more polyculture. So you need to have a fundamental reconfiguring of agriculture. And when you do this, you will have something that is not only productive enough, but is without the undesirable environmental impacts of this. And so that would be the profits way of looking at it. Polyculture, much more focusing on trees and tubers. And you can, if you want to, you can produce scientific studies showing you that. But that requires much more labor. When you have these much more complicated agricultural systems, you end up with many more people on the land. And so the question is, how can you make it possible for people to do that in a way that's pleasing and, a good way to make a living instead of being like horrible farm worker type labor? And that's a big issue.
Yeah, that's interesting. And how are you going to solve the food problem?
First of all, it's really interesting to me that you read my book and come away thinking that I'm on the wizard side of things. I mean, I guess I could see that, but I certainly see it and see my own views as more nuanced than that. I guess I see humans as sort of reluctant and incompetent planetary engineers who have to learn to be better at them, and maybe even a little bit less reluctant in some cases. But I think, in a way, I don't think it's a false dichotomy, wizard prophet, in terms of it does describe the history you describe is wonderfully described, and it does describe these two sort of poles of approaches. But I think that a lot of wise approaches to the future really involve both, in that what we are going to need is a lot of technical innovation done with great awareness of planetary limits. And so you combine both in a lot of ways. And this is especially clear when you think of the far future, which I can't help but doing. I mean, it's one thing, and we have to address the problems of this century. But if you think through to a time where we've addressed some of them, then we're confronted with some other thorny questions. Like, let's say we avoid a human-caused mass extinction, which we all really want to do, and I think that we still can do. But then, where are we left? Because if we've done that, we've sort of taken charge of the extinction of Earth, and we've said, you get to go extinct, you don't get to go extinct. Then the question is, so what's the right extinction rate? What do we do with that? Do you say it's zero? If it's zero, then that's a massive intervention in life on the planet. And that's like, then we're really playing God, if we say nobody goes extinct. But if it's not zero, then obviously that creates other thorny questions. Same thing with climate. We get over our current vandalism, which we will, but not without some damage. And then we're still left with the question, okay, we've learned how to deal with climate, and we've learned ways in which, either through wizardly or prophetic means, we can interact with the climate in a more conscious way. Then, okay, so how do we set the thermostat? We're still left with some tricky questions, which are going to, I think, require both perspectives. Now, some of these problems, I think, a lot of people like myself think, well, the best solutions are prophetic, working with natural systems as much as we can. But some of the fail-safe mechanisms, if things are worse, if things get worse, might require more wizardliness, is that a word? Mm-hmm. Because there's huge uncertainty in, even with this latest IPCC report, we still don't know our best models. I mean, I hate this phrase, the science is settled, because I understand why we use it, because it's settled enough to know we better frickin' do something. Sorry, God. But it's not settled in terms of there's a huge amount we don't know. The system's so complex, this feedback, that feedback. So we don't know how bad it's going to get. I'm really not in favor of this brute force geoengineering because we don't know enough to do it. So I'm much more in favor of planting trees and lowering our carbon and stuff. But we ought to maybe do some research in case we need it. I would say sort of the same kind of thing with food. The kinds of solutions you just described make perfect sense to me, but there's a lot that we don't know. One thing, for instance, starting to look in this IPCC report just underscored this, like we might lose the coral reefs this century completely. Now, people say permanently, and that's not true. Earth has lost its coral reefs over and over and over again through the acidification, and they come back. So 10 million years from now, we'll have coral reefs again. That doesn't help you and me, but it's not true that we need to save the Earth. You know, we need to save ourselves. But anyways.
No, I think that's a really important point. This is something that Lynn Margulis would always say. You know, Earth is fine. You know, 99% of Earth's biomass is microbial. Right. 99% of the Earth's evolutionary creativity is microbial. We're these little, you know, dots dancing on it. We're the vulnerable things. Earth is fine. So if we're going to saving the planet, it should be about saving us.
Yeah, we don't need to save the Earth. But just to finish that point, so if things go in that direction, the coral reefs go away. We don't know what else is going to happen to the ocean as a result of that. Fish protein might really be in trouble. We might need to go to massive aquaculture, fish farming on a scale we've never seen it. That's a very wizardly thing to say, and it's not my first choice, but I think we should be aware of this spectrum of responses because we don't know how the Earth is going to respond to us.
That's a good point. Well, let me just say, if anyone has questions, please raise your hand. I'm going to ask a question, and someone will come by with a microphone. So please keep your hand raised, and we'll get to everyone's questions. But I just have a quick question about the profit concept. Like, can we all live in a world with a growing population and see the profit mentality without, in my mind, sort of like someone living off the grid and, you know, in the wilderness somewhere with no, you know, really, really living close to the earth?
I think it's important to know what we're talking about here. No matter what, the predominant number of people in the world are going to be urban.
Right.
But it makes a big difference if it's 70% or 90%. And that makes a huge difference to the rest of the world. If you scatter billions of people throughout, you end up without huge areas of wild spaces. And many people who are wizards want essentially to reduce the human footprint, to pack everybody into big cities, and then, you know, with something like a giant nuclear power plant outside, and reserve the west of the world for nature. And so when somebody like E.O. Wilson talks about reserving half of Earth for nature, he's effectively endorsing that concept. So if that's what you mean and that's what you want in the world, is as much nature as possible, you almost automatically go into these hyper-urban, hyper-technological subjects. The question is whether you think that a human landscape, you know, a Jeffersonian vision of smaller communities, more interconnected, you see that as important for the human spirit, for democracy, and that sort of stuff. And so that's what I talk about when you're talking about values, is, you know, what is important and what is important to people depends a lot about what kind of technology you then choose for.
Right, right, yeah. I know, I think a lot of people come at it from the human spirit kind of viewpoint, right? Because there's an anti kind of urban.
Right, yeah, but also other people will say, no, look, and this has been true, you know, for lots of philosophers like, you know, Voltaire and Alexander Hamilton and so forth. The city is the place where people meet as equals, where it's much less stratified, where you can have maximum individual freedom. And so there's a whole, discussion about that. And more or less it's true.
That's interesting.
And so the question is, realize who we are better when we're embedded in smaller communities or when we have maximum freedom to realize our desires?
Yeah.
And this is the stuff that's been, you know, philosophers have been arguing about for a lot longer and with a lot more expertise than somebody like me.
Good. Okay, a question? Does someone have a microphone yet?
Okay. Thank you. I have a question for Charles. Thank you very much for writing The Wizard and the Prophet. I thought it was great. It's a tremendous resource if you're interested in environmental history like I am. My specific question is about the public discourse related to climate change, which has become so politicized and almost anti-scientific that if you are in one political party, you're expected to behave one way, and if you're another political party, you're expected to behave another way, and it's just become a political thing, not a scientific thing, which is really unfortunate because climate change is happening and that's based on science. The question for you is, as a writer and a public communicator, how do you communicate to the public about something so important as climate change without tripping over the fact that it has become so politicized?
Well, this is obviously a very difficult question. And so I'm going to take a small, I'm going to try to answer what I do, and not with the idea that this is a model, but it's sort of how I think about it. I think that a lot of the discourse, conversation or discussions about climate change are polarized because they've become stand-ins for other debates. If you talk to somebody and say, you know, the fundamentals of climate change are about things like the type of light that different elements in the different molecules in the atmosphere absorb, that's something that's been known, you know, since the late 19th century, and there's no discussion about it. What happens is when you have the solutions, and what people fear are the solutions that you, and that they fear that you're citing this science as a bludgeon to get them to accept certain kinds of changes to their lives that they don't, and their ideas that they don't like. And so what I think it's important to do is as much as you can, is to decouple the discussion of what is happening from what you do about it. What you do about it depends on your values, on your beliefs, and what was important, on your thoughts about what kind of future world we want. What is happening, that is a matter of dials and objective numbers and so forth. And so I do think that that distinction is important. And so frequently when I give a talk, I'm going to say, I'm going to try and tell you what I understand is happening, and I'm not going to tell you what to do. You know, you can do so. And if you all guys decide that you're going to do nothing about it, well, we're in a democracy. You know, that's the rules. I might say, think privately that that's dumb, but that's up to you. The scientist's role is to say, you know, what is happening, and that we really should pay attention to it. And I think when you start explaining the basics, and you can say what they mean by the 97% consensus and so forth, and what David was talking about so well, is that we understand the fundamental physics and chemistry of the phenomena. But the secondary effects are incredibly complicated and are really hard to understand. So we understand that something is happening, that something's probably happening very quickly on a geological scale, but exactly what it is, we don't know. And we should really pay attention to that. And how we think about risk in the future will determine the kind of policy we have. And so, again, you know, trying to decouple has been, at least for me, on a personal level, successful.
It's a great question, because, and I really want to get your response to it, because right before we came out here, we were talking about the scientist's role a little bit in this. I'd love to get your thoughts on where science fits into it and a scientist's personal viewpoint.
Yeah, I mean, very nice answer. But the one thing you just said, that there's a scientist's role, is simply to sort of describe what's happening.
No, I shouldn't have said that. That's key to the scientist's role.
Absolutely.
And when it's really important, they wave a red flag.
Yeah. But I mean, this is vexing. What exactly is the scientist's role? We're in sort of new territory here. There's this legal concept of duty to rescue. You know, it's one thing to describe the world, but if you suddenly see an emergency, I mean, if you see a house burning down, you're not just going to like take infrared measurements and write a paper about it. You know, you're going to try to like scream and get people out of there. And so at what point, though, do we cross over, and what do we lose when we cross over to advocacy? Then do we lose our perceived role as being these sort of neutral, attempted neutral arbiters? So it's vexing. But what I do, and the question you ask, how do you talk to people given this tribal polarization, all that, is really difficult and important. And it's something I've thought about and worked on a lot. One thing I try to do is be aware of who I'm talking to, listen, don't just talk, and try to understand what is of concern to whoever you're talking to, and find some point of commonality. There's usually a point of commonality, and try to build from that. And because of my particular background as a planetary scientist, sometimes I use parables from other planets as a way just to make people go, oh, I never thought of it that way. I actually found myself in the office a couple years ago of I don't want to use the word notorious, but a well-known Tea Party Republican congressperson, and I was in his office because of as my role as a chair at the Library of Congress, you get these courtesy invitations. And this guy's a famous, you know, I don't like this word, but climate denier, skeptic, whatever you want to call it. All those words are bad in different ways. But and I thought, well, how am I going to talk to this guy, you know, about these issues? But I felt like I should try. But I learned that he was a huge fan of space exploration and a big supporter of NASA. So we started talking about missions to Venus and the greenhouse effect there, and then used that as a way to start saying, well, yeah, wouldn't it be great if we could reduce the uncertainty in our understanding of climate models, and found a surprising and unanticipated to me terrain of sort of commonality with this person. So I think you have to tailor the way you speak to what you're hearing from other people and try to find those common points of belief and concern.
That's really interesting. Any other questions for now? Over here. We'll get in the back next.
So I don't think anything will be done until there's disaster. Like, people will be dying. Cities will be flooded out. Can you give me some hope that this will not come to pass?
My perspective is that human beings learn to simplify in two ways. We are somewhat uniquely gifted with the power of foresight in the animal community, both as individuals and culturally. We have some ability to see and predict the future, to model the future, to react to what we see in those models, but we often learn the hard way. That's true about individuals. Growing up, you know, you're warned, but you often learn by, you know, you touch the stove and it hurts and then you don't do it again, not even though somebody told you it was going to hurt. It's true collectively, too. We have some power of foresight. We can do climate models. We can do forecasting. We can sometimes avoid the worst. I see it very much as a combination of those two. People tend to look at climate change as this cliff that we're either going to go off or not go off. It's not like that. It's a series of trajectories, a whole wide range of trajectories. The worst case is that we do nothing, and then it hits us in the way you're describing, and then we try to pick up the pieces. The best case is that we see it coming, and we make all these proactive changes to our energy system, and we stop. That's neither of those extreme cases is going to happen. Something in between is going to happen, and our task, therefore, is to hasten the change in our energy systems, and as concerned citizens, to try to push towards the good future, which is as much as possible guided by foresight, and as less as possible, and least guided by response to disaster. It's going to be some combination of the two because we're human beings and we muddle through things.
I'm going to ask a question, but someone in the back had their hand raised too, and you can come go after my question because I'm the moderator. but just talking about the future, Charles, you brought this up, and the way out, and your book really talks about it is what do we owe the future, right? Like, this is a question you raised right before it came out, and I'd like you to answer it. Like, what do we owe the future?
I'm just saying it's very common in this kind of thing to say, you know, that we owe the future something. You know, think of what's going to happen in future generations. And you have an instinctive, at least I do, an instinctive sense that, yes, we do, but it's really hard to, the moment you go past that initial sort of burst of enthusiasm, it's really hard to figure out what that means. Because if we look at the past, it's pretty clear that the people in the past didn't want this future, that, you know, our future. Look at 1800. In that time, slavery is legal everywhere in the world and widely approved by, you know, most people. Women are not allowed to own property, participate in public life, go to anywhere in the world, you know, basically. And you can go on and on. If you had asked those people what it would be like to have a world in which women were the moderators, where a bunch of guys are underneath them, you know, where, you know, women are in control of a festival where half the writers are women, I mean, they would have thought this was bad. They would have they said that there would be no slavery legal in any world. They would have unquestionably thought this was bad. If they could have assured the future, if they wanted in 1800, they would have assured a future that we would regard as a nightmare. And so it's very difficult to say what, you know, that we know what these people want because they're not born yet. They don't exist. And so it's extremely complicated to actually do this. In the book, I talk about that if you had gone to the Lenape people, who are the people who lived in Manhattan in 1600, and said, shown them current Manhattan, you know, with its all these tremendous temples of learning and culture and so forth, and these bustling streets and shops, or the beautiful, diverse ecosystem that was their home, I'm pretty sure they would have voted for the ecosystem that was their home, and there wouldn't be a Met Museum, there wouldn't be any Columbia University, there wouldn't be any of these things. So when we talk about the future and what we owe them, it becomes immediately difficult to actualize that. And I'll give you an example. It's almost every economist, left and right, agrees that the world is getting richer.
Right.
And at some point, you know, in 2100, the world is going to be six to ten times richer than it is. If we do climate change the wrong way, we could take a serious economic hit. Mm-hmm. And a substantial portion of those people in the future would be much poorer than they would be otherwise. Are those people going to go back and say we made the right choice? So that's the kind of complicated question that we have. And I think it's important for us to realize that we're operating in the unknown for this. And without sort of unthinkingly projecting our prejudices and biases on the future, because if they had done that in 1800, that would have been a terrible thing.
Yeah.
As far as what we owe the future, it may seem like a strange thing for a scientist to say, but I think in a way that's fundamentally a spiritual question.
Yeah.
And, you know, damn it, Jim, I'm an astrobiologist, not a theologian. But but given our current setting, it's part of what makes us human is the ability to identify with groups larger than ourselves. And I'm thinking more and more, I mean, Carl Sagan, again, my mentor, a big influence, used to talk about the history of increasing our identification horizons from just you, your family group, your clan, your hunter-gatherer group, your nation state, and then ultimately maybe the human race. We can think of that temporally too, you know, identifying with other generations. And indeed, that has been a hallmark of our species. You know, when we developed language, part of that was the ability to communicate difficult, what they called long-chain complex recipe technologies to future generations. Sharing our culture and our technology with others required language. And already when we started doing that, we were collaborating with our descendants. And you think of, churches and cathedrals and that were built in the past, and that people were motivated to work on these projects that were multi-generational. And in a certain sense, when we talk about climate change and solving these problems that go so beyond our individual lives, we're driven to ask that question, you know, can we identify in this way that goes beyond our immediate generation? And I think there's plenty of evidence that we can. And if I were going to go beyond being a scientist and try to make normative statements, I would say that, you know, that is something that we need to get better at, that now that we are realizing we are a geological force, we have to think of ourselves as embedded in deep time. And so thinking on the time scale of an individual human life will never solve our problems. And so we are obligated unless we convince ourselves that we only care about the present generation.
But it's not even, I would argue that it's more complex than that. For instance, I was reaching this book. I went to India a couple of times, and I talked to a woman there named Sunita Narain, who is a prominent environmentalist, and she was talking about India having 400 million people who lack electricity, and the choice that the Indian government has been making to provide them electricity with coal, which obviously has huge climate impacts. And she was saying, now think of this. You're saying don't do this because the sea level will rise. But I go to the Netherlands, to Amsterdam. That is a city where the sea level has risen. Amsterdam is not so bad. So should I sacrifice those 400 million people so that you don't have to pay for Amsterdam? And that's the kind of question that becomes, you know, to the forefront with climate change. It's very difficult to know what the right answer. What will our ancestor descendants say? Will they say you did the right thing by letting the sea levels rise so that the Indians could have coal?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's complicated for reasons like that, and it's regionally, there are regionally distinct problems. And Amsterdam's an interesting example, because I talk to people in the Netherlands and say, well, you're below sea level, you guys must be worried. And they're like, oh, no, we're not worried. We know how to deal with this.
Well, I have more questions that, but let me, who's up next? Someone in the back, I believe. Oh, no, someone had their hand raised. Did it?
Yeah, there's one.
Oh, okay, great. Thanks.
So I'm just going to have to take some exception to your example about the coal in India, because there are so many, like, emerging things that this, and I even say the next generation down from me is doing, the permaculturalists, the herbalists, the foragers, the low-tech solar folk. I mean, part of the problem is that it's not part of policy, because capitalism doesn't see a way to make cash out of it. But, you know, people in many developing, what we call developing countries, were growing food really well and doing things on a much better scale than we were until we came in with our experts and Monsantoized them and taught them how to grow, but really created vast wastelands. So I'm going to have to take some exception to your example there. And so, like, why can't good folk who are working on technology of a small, low-scale solar, of which I know some in India, and work that way, so that we're not doing the big electro plants, we're not doing the big coal, but we're going into communities, asking them what they need, and then shut the hell up so that we listen and we help them with our sense of expertise, as opposed to be the white male American hero that's going to come in and fix the problem. So if you could respond to that.
Sure. What you're saying is, of course, completely correct, until you consider Indian history. India has a ministry of coal. It's the only nation in the entire world with an entire government ministry of coal. Coal is intrinsic to the entire Indian independence movement and nationalist enterprise. You know, if you read Nehru or any of those things, the whole idea of the modern Indian state. So there's an enormous homegrown and formidable bureaucratic momentum behind coal. If you're going to do the kind of small-scale network solar installations, which are great, don't get me wrong, you are fighting against a tremendous homegrown Indian bureaucracy. And I'll give you an example. There's in southern India, there's a number of foundations that are seeking to do, to equip Indian villages with low-scale solar installations, which are exactly the kind of type you talk about. And I visited them, and they talked about the enormous difficulties they have. And one of them is that the Indian banks won't loan villages money to do this, because there's no safety guarantees from the government for these solar installations. And they've been fighting 20 years for this, and they've been fought by the Ministry of Coal. And so what Sunita Narain is saying is, while we're fighting for this, these people are had an entire generation in which they've grown up without electric light. Without electric light, kids can't do their homework. Women can't do extra work at home. When you go to a village that has a light and a village next door that doesn't, the difference is just enormous. And so she's saying, are we so wrong to throw in the towel and say, you guys take this because this is the path dependence that we're on? I'm not saying she's right. I'm not saying she's it. But these are, it's not so simple.
And the thing that may save them and save us from their coal is air pollution. I mean, the Chinese cannot exploit all their coal because the air pollution is getting so bad in Chinese cities. And the same thing is happening in India now. So, that's almost in a weird way a kind of silver lining, that through their self-interest, even if they're not, the most altruistic governments in the world in some ways, they cannot, if China burns all their coal, we're toast, but they can't burn all their coal because you can no longer breathe in Beijing. So they're searching for other solutions desperately for that reason.
Right. And the India, I think, will eventually come there. But
the trade-offs are much more complex than they sometimes seem to us on, you know, sitting.
I think you're totally right. I mean, I think a lot of the climate problems we solve through these things, like these byproducts that affect our breathing in water.
And this is actually also, I think, a source of hope, because it's important to remember that we don't have a climate problem. We have a climate problems, and that it's different in different places. And that means it has to be attacked on national, regional, local, and, you know, levels. And so even as our national government is tremendously paralyzed, it's important to note that cities around the world are organizing in this way. There's coalitions of cities. That's where 70% of the world, the top 100 cities in the globe, I forget what the name of it is, have organized and have reduced it. Governments of all scales around the world have said no more internal combustion engines after certain times. So that even though the headlines are quite right, properly about what the guys in Washington are doing, it's important to remember there's all this other stuff happening in other scales that are very positive.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. Okay, this is our last question, and I'm going to give it to you guys because I have many of them. But someone's hand is raised. I can't see that well out here. Oh, great.
There's a hand over here.
Okay. Hi. Thank you so much for coming and speaking with us. I guess a lot of us have that mindset of what has posterity done for us. So at the end of the day, does my becoming a vegan, does my, if it's yellow, let it mellow, these types of actions, do they really count for anything when we have 400 million people coming into the middle class in India? I mean, you see this statistic saying that corporations are responsible for 71% of all carbon emissions. So why is it my fault, and what do I need to do? So I'm just curious.
So I think the question is, given the scale of the problems we're talking about, does individual action, how often you flush your toilet and all that, really make it, whether you use plastic straws or not, you know, is it all just a drop in the bucket? And, you know, we're not going to get through these problems in a graceful way without both transformations in the way individuals live their lives in specific cultures and large-scale policy changes, and not just government changes, but evolution of corporate ethics. And, you know, I think it's going to take change at a lot of different scales. And so I would say individual action of the kind you're describing is necessary, but not sufficient. It's also important to vote and make your views known on wider scales. But these things do add up, and especially because, as I alluded before, I think, you know, there is, if I can phrase it this way, a spiritual aspect to this, which is that the way we perceive ourselves in relationship to the wider world as individuals and in groups en masse ultimately changes everything. It's about cultural change as much as anything, and a sort of reinvention. You know, if we get through this, I would say when we get through this, I think we will, but again, I don't know with how much damage being done, it will be with a changed sense of the way we as individuals and as a global culture are in relation to the planet, realizing our long-term embeddedness in planetary systems. And so that realization of the fact that we live on a planet and that we're connected in complex ways to people all around the planet is a cultural change that is happening. Whether it's happening quickly enough is an interesting question, but I think that's the big challenge in a way. So those little changes in consciousness and how you live your lives and how you communicate with other people, it spreads. And, you know, there's non-linearities in the physical systems, which make it so hard to predict what's going to happen. But there are also non-linearities in human systems and in the way we interact. And cultural change spreads in these very difficult to predict ways. And that ultimately may be as important as any of the technical changes. And so in that sense, I would say the way we behave in our individual lives and the way we communicate about that is as important as anything.
No, that's a good point. And so recycle. I think this is all the time we have. I know everyone has a lot more questions, so thank you. Book signing in the back. This is great.